Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And as we continue to remind you regarding our appeals to heaven and how important that is, we need to ensure that we keep on learning, praying, and acting. So I just want to just keep reminding you that going through this content, reading, taking the time to understand the Constitution, believe it or not, there was a league of statesmen. When we look at the Declaration of Independence, there was a bevy, there was a large group of men that were statesmen, that were leading their local areas. This took time to develop, folks. When we look at the 1763, dismantling of the colony government, where the king injected his own rulers, his own magistrates, to basically govern the people, it took time from that point to the 1775 era, where a lot of men started actually standing up against the tyranny. Thomas Jefferson was one of those men. George Mason, even in the, because Washington wasn't a statesman, but he was a leader. So those hard times developed statesmen. Now, we have a lot of entertainers today. They're not statesmen. They could be statesmen. Some of these guys are educated. I mean, I pick on Charlie Kirk all the time. That guy's got an education. It's too bad that he's illiterate on the Constitution because he's never read the source documents. He doesn't actually integrate the concept of how the framers actually defined the Constitution through the ratification debates. Unless you've done that, unless you've actually seen and understood why they did what they did, and what they actually did, like the establishment of this equal footing in bringing states into the Union, this concept of American republicanism. I mean, there's so many things that people just gloss over. We're here to help develop statesmen. And I believe that as a part of that process is this appeal to heaven. Now, in addition to that, this is why we focus on this curriculum. This is why on Tuesday, whatever that was, the 2nd, I think. Yeah, it was the 2nd, where I started going through the curriculum. Believe it or not, as I looked at it and as I analyzed it, I wanted to actually, and I made some changes to it, because I want to make sure that this is a very logical flow so that we really understand what happened. Now, I guess I could try to go through how and what the king did and everything beforehand. I just don't think that's that important. The fact is the states or the colonies were being attacked, and the colonies began basically evolving into independent states. The way they did that was prior to the Tory Acts, these colonists used their rights as Englishmen, and maybe that's what I need to do is, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to put it into the curriculum, the rights of Englishmen. And so that way, we can actually talk about the Magna Carta, and we can actually talk about the Glorious Bill of Rights. Then it just drives us right into the Tory Acts, because I think my website should have the Glorious Bill of Rights, and I think my website should also have the Magna Carta. That way, you'll have the links to go to the source documents, but we'll also have those in a PDF or Word document, so it's a little easier to go through. But the point is having all of these documents and having the logical flow so that you can actually see what was happening at each step. They didn't instantly break into a three-branch government before they even formed the Articles of Confederation or the Articles of Association. So that's why we step through this. Another point that we bring up is this concept, the paradigm that these men had at that point in time. And so the three things that we need to talk about is, what I would call the scale of liberty. The other one would be natural law. And then the other one would be common law. These are fixed paradigms that they had at that point in time. That it was all based on this British paradigm. These men didn't have what we call the new American paradigm. They considered themselves Americans, but at that point in time, they were steeped in the English government, in the English, you know, laws, legal system, and so forth. I mean, they broke away from that, and they actually created a completely different system. They created a completely different common law. And the common law was based on the state, not on England. In other words, each state had their own sovereignty. Each state, at the beginning of the Constitution, when the Constitution was ratified, there were eight states. I say this all the time. There were eight states that were actually theocracies. And so those eight states had to evolve to basically put aside their theocracy and actually become a a tolerant state of religious freedom. Because the Constitution was demanding for itself, for the federal government, tolerance. And everybody started seeing, I'll just say, the divine hands, or I should say, yeah, the divine hand of Providence's DNA within that Constitution. So they started migrating and integrating that Constitution. It's interesting how they started providing the U.S. Constitution to almost all nations in the world received a copy. There are many nations that actually tried to copy us. They couldn't because they didn't have the foundation. They just didn't go through this. The only way a state in the world could actually become a part of this union is through the admission process. They actually have to go through a transition and understanding what it takes to do that. Handing a person a piece of paper is not a transition make. How's that sound? So as I go through this, because I want to kind of recap this. So again, September 2nd and or September 5th, we cover the curriculum. And the curriculum has actually been tweaked quite a bit. So we're now introducing the rights of Englishmen, because it was just that dynamic and I think it was that relevant, to the Tory Acts. So in other words, we'll start off the Tory Acts with this, the paradigm of England and the rights of Englishmen, the Tory Acts, then the scale of liberty, natural law, and common law. Madison's essay on property is the next thing we're going to hit, and then we'll die, because that's a part of the paradigm. Even though that's, I think it's a 1792, it's an older document, but it's a short outlier document that I believe helps everybody understand why what was happening was so important. And then we'll kind of chronologically start covering everything else. And for, I'll just say, we do a very good job in laying this out chronologically. So the Articles of Association and the very first petition, that's the next step. So now that they've created the Tory Acts, they started organizing themselves, technically before the Tory Acts, before those things, because the Tory Acts, or I should say, these provincial governments were created. These provincial governments ended up creating the Articles of Association and that very first petition to the king. Then eventually the Declaration of Independence. Now the Declaration of Independence I don't list here because we usually read that on July 2nd, not July 4th. The nation recognizes July 4th because that's what Thomas Jefferson did. And I think that's when he actually read it at Faneuil Hall, I believe, on the balcony. Nevertheless, as we kind of look at the Declaration of Independence, we want to recognize when the majority of the signatures were attached to that document was on the 2nd. That's when it was ready. That's when they started signing it. Technically, that's when it was galvanized. It was more, I'll just say, formalized as far as the celebration when Thomas Jefferson was president. That's why we have the 4th. Anyway, and he thought it was, you know, I say this all the time, and I'm not disparaging the man. He was a great man. I wish I could even, you know, amount to just a fragment of this man's stature. That being said, while he was president, he had the opportunity to basically integrate the recognition of the Declaration of Independence as a nation, and so that everybody would remember his work. Isn't that nice? I mean, Washington didn't do it. Adams didn't do it. But Jefferson did. And, you know, I don't fault the man, because it was the foundation. It was the bedrock. That document became the bedrock of what we actually became as a nation, right? Governments are instituted by men, we the people. Okay, so again, we cover the first petition, then we dive into the Articles of Confederation, the drafting of those, and then we talk about the ratification of those, and then we go through the amendments to the Articles of Confederation. Then we'll go through the definitive treaty of peace, because the ratification, and actually maybe we'd, you know, switch the amendments, but it doesn't matter. The definitive treaty of peace is what we agreed to with England. And we go through this to actually prove that we didn't honor it, nor did they honor it. There's no way we were going to, we didn't pay a red penny. The reason we didn't pay a penny was because those traitors basically cost us valuable lives, because they decided to support the British cause in America. And we just, they considered them traitors. This is why they basically stripped them of their assets and sent them out. Now, I want you to understand something here. This is a point in time when the colonists felt that they needed to break the bonds of Britain. Now, it's not like, if we really look at the degree of traitor from then to today, what Bill Gates, what DeSoros, what all these people who are living here, even as citizens, and spending the money to destroy the Constitution and our government, the degree of traitor, right? If you had this, you know, this suckometer, right? You know, who sucks the most? Did the old Englishmen suck more, or do the traitors today? By far, that suckometer is way overpegged hard. I mean, it's like people look at that, it must be broken. No, that's how bad the people today are. When we look at communists in America, they're pegging the suckometer. When we look at Islamists in America, Mohammedans, that's pegging the suckometer. They have no desire to allow you. So folks, keep in mind, the whole premise and the whole point of this nation is that every person learns for themselves and chooses for themselves. You have to choose what you want to do and what to do. If you choose not to be a part of our society, you have every right to unplug and become your own person. And we hopefully won't mess with you. But if you start doing things that are flagrantly violating our laws, like driving a car without a license, then you deserve to be locked up for whatever indeterminate amount of time without a writ of habeas corpus. You're not a citizen. I want you to understand this. This applies to anybody, the Mohammedans, it doesn't matter. And if you really want to make a ruckus, then we'll deport your butt. We'll strip all of your assets from you, just like we did the Tories. So the Tories, a part of that Tories Act, is 100,000 British loyalists were stripped of their goods. They were basically put on ships with the shirts on their back, and they were sent out. I mean, they probably had some belongings in their hands. I mean, they weren't that bad. But I'm telling you, today, people just deserve to basically have the fundamentals, a jogging suit, that's it, if it's wintertime. And if not, a tank top and shirt, and that's it, or shorts, and that's it. Flip-flops, nothing else. You're out of here. So then we go into the definitive treaty, like I said, and then the next step is what we want to cover, because this is 1785, Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments. This is where the concept really took foot, and it was actually documented in a document of the importance of tolerance, religious tolerance. Then we'll dive into the Annapolis Convention. And then from that, we'll dive into the selection of the state delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Then, at that point in time, we'll dive into the Northwest Ordinance. And this is, we're going to cover it then because it was 1787 when it was ratified by Congress in July. Continental Congress hadn't, or not Continental Congress, the Constitutional Convention had already started to meet, but they hadn't finished. And so we want to make sure that we point out how the Constitution actually addressed far more succinctly and far more adequately, or I should say, appropriately, in maintaining the sovereignty of states and the paradigm that they developed over this stupid compact that they made called the Northwest Ordinance. Yeah, there are some good things that people like about it, but it gives a central government too much power. And had we not gone into the Constitution, we would have had a far more central-powered Continental Congress. Far more powerful. Because over time, they, as these new territories would come in under Congress, either we would have a centralized government with more power, without definitive powers or delineated powers that the Constitution created, or they would have actually gone, like I said this, that they would have probably ended up going into religious wars and so forth, because under Continental Congress, they would have ultimately created more and more theocracies, and they would have been Anglican Church. So the outlier churches would have actually started losing the battle, and we would actually have seen oppression and those types of things probably in the first century, along with all sorts of other problems, slavery and all these other things, that there was no mechanism in the Articles of Confederation to right the ship. So anyway, we'll dive into the next series, which is the Enabling Act. So once we cover, hold on here. I think I missed something. Yes, I did. So Madison's assessments, I missed a whole page. Then the Annapolis Convention, and then we get into the state selections, the Northwest Ordinance is where we were, the Constitutional Convention, then Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, and then we'll get into the American Republicanism. This is just a short glimpse of what happened. What was this new form of Republican form of government? The exemplar within the Constitution, what they ended up doing in the Constitution to create this a Republicanism that had never, ever been created. Then we'll dive into the ratification debates. Then we'll dive into the overview of the Federalist Papers of how Hamilton created the poisonous pill. That was the beginning of the overreach that was going to go on steroids because of the court and what Hamilton did. Then we'll dive into the first acts of Congress. At that same point in time, we're going to be looking at these other equally trying times, because we want to actually kind of cover the Enabling Acts, and then we want to cover the cod fishery bounties. The Enabling Acts we're going to cover, because we're going to actually cover the Enabling Acts in two different series. The first one will be the Equal Footing, which is where we cover Vermont and Tennessee and Kentucky and Louisiana and Ohio and whatever other state, if I'm missing one, then that state that is brought into the Union. The next few, I think maybe Alabama might be one. But anyway, then we'll take a pause and we'll start diving into the cod fishery bounties, Madison and Jefferson and Hamilton's compromise that created the Assumption Act. Then we'll dive into the Bank Act and how everything started really building and how Hamilton was literally on a full frontal assault against the Constitution with this charge of implied powers. And so when we look at what he was doing with implied powers, these were hard infractions in creating this bank. So then we'll dive into the Whiskey Rebellion, because that was another part of Hamilton. The Assumption Act actually finally gave, because for the federal government to tax, they needed to have a good amount of debt to actually say, you need to start paying us, and this is the apportionment that we're assigning you in the direct tax. So you have to pay these taxes. So the when we look at the Assumption Act, it actually created this large pile of debt. And everybody became benefactors. Every state was, it was a win for every state as far as income or revenue or relief one way or the other. And in so doing, it created this large amount of debt. So then they started actually taxing. And a part of that taxing process created the Whiskey Rebellion. We'll dive into the 11th Amendment. I've never done this, but I think this is where I've wanted to do this by looking at the Continental, or not the Continental, the Annals of Congress, and going through how Congress debated this concept and the pushback from the states regarding the judiciary. They didn't convene a convention. So in other words, Congress, and through the state's representation, probably in the Senate and in the House, started demanding that you get rid of the jurisdiction of the court in this manner. This is how we actually reel in the court. It's through Congress. Congress has the power to regulate them. Who has the power to persuade them? Well, the state legislature has all the power over the Senate. And we, the people, need to demand, but we need to get appropriate representation. Because right now we've been watered down to where our representatives are only representing the corporations that are paying for them. Because remember, they made corporations as persons. Anyway, so we'll cover the 11th Amendment, then we're going to dive into the five critical documents. Out of the entire year, this discussion, these shows that will cover these five critical documents, these documents will prove to you exactly what we need to do every time there's an infraction. We cannot allow an infraction to go unnoticed, and to call them out and say, you better start walking that back, and let them know that we are watching them in everything they do. Back in those days, they didn't have the ability to do that. But folks, we have real-time governing. We have real-time monitoring. We can actually get engaged. And in a way, when you look at it at the county level, this is kind of like what Bob Schultz had been thinking about in trying to create a fourth branch of government. But technically, that fourth branch of government, or that the footstool of the republic, are your counties. And so this is why the counties need to have citizen committees, like their own little county congress, where they actually help set what, you know, needs to be done for your county commissioners or supervisors or what have you, regarding infrastructure, regarding commerce, regarding the things that really matter to you. What kind of businesses do you need? What kind of businesses do you not need? Those types of things. Then we'll dive into the vetoes of the Department of Transportation. So at this point in time, there's just a lot of things that we need to cover before Constitution Day. But we've already covered, I think I covered it above, the ratification base, the Federalist Papers. So now we're going to cover the Monroe Doctrine, because this is something I try to cover every year. And we are going to cover the Manifest Destiny, why that was important. Because again, this concept of seizing the land moving forward, because right, wrong, or indifferent, I don't say this enough, had America not seized all the land from sea to shining sea, Britain would have seized it, they would have fought for it, they would have possessed it, or somebody else would be possessing it. The fact that the indigenous or the American Indians were there, they didn't care, none the wiser, there was a massive colonization going on, if that's what you want to call it. And what America was doing was it was spreading liberty. When you look at every nation in the world today, do you wish that you had China, the Chinese Communist Party in America ruling you? I mean, just look at what they're doing with their 15-minute cities and the tyranny and the live organ harvesting. Look at the atrocities that China's doing. And nobody talks about that, but they talk about the evil American colonization. Are you kidding me? So anyway, we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're actually going to go into something that's completely new that we did this year, because as we continue to seek for the truth, let me just say this, Jim. Having had my first taste of a corporate journalist, now, most people consider what we call mainstream journalism. Technically, it's corporate journalism. And so they talk about mainstream, right, with the progressive left. Technically, what you look at for the, you know, the what we would call Fox and all of those different, you know, OAN, or is it OAN? I think it is. Newsmax, that's corporate journalism. None of them are looking and seeking the truth. None of them are actually criticizing and always focused on the Constitution. This is what they need to be doing. That's not constitutional, Trump. You can't just take troops in to Chicago. Can't take troops in to LA. There is a process to doing that. And so, right, wrong, or indifferent, and I'm going to say it now, because I'm sure there's all these sound bites out there that, because they've been talking about this for a long time. We don't care to talk about it because that is, they're not giving you any context. Maybe we need to do that, and maybe we'll get to that point. But the reality is this, that when there are problems, the Constitution actually has a mechanism. What Trump should have been doing is he should have been going in and removing the public servants who were failing to support the Constitution. Get rid of them. Then when you get the right people in there, they'll actually start using law enforcement the way they're supposed to be using them. They'll actually do the job for the people, because the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is the supreme law of the land, and there's no reason why he's not enforcing it, other than the fact that America needs a national law enforcement army. Don't forget, it was Obama that said he was going to fundamentally transform America by creating a national enforcement agency. Bush helped start this. They're all basically taking the idea of creating a national enforcement agency. Trump actually, you know, saw everything, and he had to let everything get bad in the 2019, 2020, as we started building up into this. This is all the preparation for the new state, this new state national enforcement. Now that we've got the National Guard, the federal government is going to be occupying the states with our National Guard, in complete contrast to the Constitution. I think I was saying the other day, and actually you'll probably hear this coming up when I was talking to Tammy as we were pre-recording. When we look at how the design of the Constitution should have been implemented, everybody sat on their hands, and actually everybody started recognizing the advantages, or I should say, the ability for them to create their own fiefdom by creating municipal enforcements. In other words, basically mercenary enforcement systems, whether that be the state, you know, the state patrol, or whether that be your city patrol. Bottom line, the people that were supposed to have arms and supposed to be well-regulated and disciplined and engaged in protecting the people was the militia. That was the design. It was the bedrock of our national security system as well as law enforcement, right? Because Congress has the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws. Everybody ignored it. And I think that that was a part of the plan as they turned the corner in the early 1800s, and actually it was around probably the 1812. After that war, they said, you know what, we kind of, because the first mercenary force that was formed was New York. And after that, everybody started creating their own little mercenary forces. And every time you do, the call from those mercenary forces is, man, we need to take the guns from the people. They've completely turned their back. And they have, from that point forward, began this little onslaught on the Constitution, which is why we've created these little factions called, you know, the, you know, DEA or DEI, the, you know, the, you know, the education factions, the Second Amendment factions, the abortion factions, you know, we've been factionalized because, oh, well, this is the most important. Free speech. You can't have free speech without your guns. I mean, everybody's arguing what part of the Constitution is the most important. Every line is important. Quit cherry picking. Quit telling people to turn their backs on the rest of the Constitution. Oh, they do that because they make money. Again, this goes back to when I was saying statesmen. These people in the mainstream media, or what I call corporate journalists, they're not statesmen. These people in front of microphones telling us what we need to be doing, back in the old days, those would have been statesmen. Because they had the wisdom, they understood, they were literate. Most of these guys aren't even literate. And those that have some literacy, because I started the show off on Kirk, they still don't understand the Constitution, which they're leading us astray. And all of their comments, you know, like, it just, it kills me. Because the concept of reparations comes up all the time. And Kirk always deals with it in the same way, unconstitutionally. Reparations are unconstitutional. It is tantamount to an ex post facto law, and as well as bills of attainder and punishment. So, they're unconstitutional. You know, game over. The problem was we had some laws that were problematic. And we got right. It took a civil war to get things right. And when government needs to get right, then we get it right and move forward. We don't go back and say, well, you kind of suffered. And the people that are calling for reparation, because we've been programmed to be, you know, so weak-kneed and so guilt-ridden. Oh, we did these bad things. Everybody did these bad things. America did not invent slavery. As a matter of fact, I've been hearing the rhetoric from people that Britain is the one that brought the end of slavery, and that is so wrong. The Declaration of Independence was the seed that started the true conversation of ending slavery. And it started in America first, because we actually went through it in the ratification debates, where they were pointing out that the northern states and the eastern states were getting rid of their slaves. They were abolishing slavery. They saw the writing on the wall. Oh, well, Britain, remember, every state is an independent and sovereign state. So in other words, Massachusetts was the first state in the world probably to be the staunchest on ending slavery. There were probably other states too. You know, I'm not going to say it's just Massachusetts, but when we really want to give credit to where credit is due, these states are independent and sovereign states, just like China, just like Britain, just like Australia. Most people don't look at it that way. But that's actually the truth. We have a union just like the European Economic Union. We have a union that is very defined for very specific purposes. Our general government doesn't have all powers, but everybody's bought into this concept that they do. Folks, what have I been saying all this time? So when we actually start talking about who get what nation gets the credit for ending slavery, we need to start identifying, because France had lip service. I mean, France had colonies that had slaves, but in France themselves, they started undoing it. And so maybe they start, maybe that was the planting of the seed. But the formal planting of the Declaration to the world was in that Declaration of Independence. And that really was the seed that started an energetic application of ending slavery. And as soon as we started ending slavery, it just started migrating back. And now we see slavery in Africa and these other third world nations. And we see slavery heavily being implemented under the Chinese colonization system. Same thing with Islam. The communists and the Islamists, the Mohammedans, they actually believe slavery is good. Statism is slavery. Come on. Anyway, before I run out of time. So we kind of left off with this idea of the manifest destiny and us expanding and basically preparing territories to become admitted into the Union of States. Now, there were all sorts of problems with that, and I'm not going to get into the Indian treaties, but if we can, we will, and I hope somebody kind of pings me on that. But the next thing we're going to get into is a whole new curriculum. We're then going to get into the evolution of the first Ponzi scheme. And so the first Ponzi scheme are these documents where the land acts that created the public lands, 1783 or 85, 86, something like that, going into 1800-something. Anyway, these were the first acts in surveying and managing. We're going to gloss over that one. But then we're going to get into the Western Lands and the Home Department dialogue so that we could see that Congress was recognizing this need and the importance of managing the territories properly in selling the land and getting states into the Union. Then we're going to get into the 1820 April 24 Land Act is what it was called. And so then we'll get into the Enabling Acts, because technically the Enabling Acts should be before the Public Land Acts. And so that's Indiana, Mississippi, Illinois, and then we're going to get into Missouri, because the Missouri overreach, not only did they imply all of these different things, this is where the government assumed the authority to dictate to states that you had to be slave states. Then we'll get into the act making further provisions for that's what the Land Act before that. Then we'll get into the railroads. Why? Why will we get into the railroads? Because when we get into the railroads, we'll actually find out that the federal government was actually using that as a new way of appropriating land and then giving it to corporations. This was kind of, if you really look at it, the railroad and the railroad corporations was the first injection of a relationship of the government mollycoddling corporations going down. And I don't have it in the curriculum. It's something we may want to look at, but we don't have the exposure of how corporations became persons and citizens with the right to vote and so forth. So we'll cover the railroads, then we're going to dive into the regulating deposits of the public money, which is this Andrew Jackson Act that he did in 1836, not 63. And then we'll get into the regulating of the deposits, and this is not actually Andrew Jackson, this is Martin Van Buren. As we dive into the next page, the last part of the Ponzi scheme, because again, this is all under the Ponzi scheme of how the federal government started taking state land so they could ingratiate themselves with more money and basically create this shiny city, you know, on top of a hill, or actually in the dumps of the Potomac, mortar on the Potomac, which was D.C., most of the land that they were taking, they were putting into the District of Columbia, or I should say, most of the money that they were taking from selling the land was going into D.C. We covered that already. Then we'll get into the Treaty of Hidalgo. Why are we getting into that? Because this actually, oh, so I didn't mention, I probably glossed over this, the Preemptive Act of 1841. This is where the federal government lays it down like this is gospel law. We owned all state land. If it's not already procured by a person, then we own it. This is before they started even assuming, you know, this control over the soil, over minerals and so forth. They were already playing with that in Indiana. And they never, there may have been a mineral act of Congress. Maybe we need to find that. Where did Congress actually assume the, unconstitutionally assume the authority that they control everything under the ground? That gold under the ground on your property is not yours. Hold on here. That's not in the Constitution. It is yours. Anyway, so we're going to cover the Treaty of Hidalgo because this is critical. This is the forming of the last segments of America taking us from sea to shining sea. What we know as the contiguous states of the United States, that act right there, or that treaty, actually galvanized that. There was just a little teeny small parcels of land, I think in Arizona and maybe New Mexico. That was it. Little teeny parcels that we ended up acquiring because there were some people on the other side or what have you. We said they're citizens, we're going to take that and we'll pay for it. So that was the beginning, and that was the sign that every stitch of land that we cared to have, and now it was just a matter of transitioning into the Union with equal footing. No, we're not doing that. And that's why in 1849, they created the Department of Home. They wanted to set the signals and let everybody know we've assumed control. The Department of Home, which we call the Department of Interior, is when they sent that out to say, we have now assumed control over the states, your land, and so forth. The Louisiana Purchase is something we'll go back to cover, and then the convention between the U.S. and the French Republic, that treaty, that's all a part of that treaty. The Treaty of Ghent, we'll cover that, and then we'll cover the Organic Act at this point, because by this point, they've put so much money into D.C. that they want to make it a state. They got families in there now. It's a state now. We want to make a state. And that's when they assumed the first step of becoming a state. And while nobody was watching, they actually started not just veering away. They literally were violating the Constitution by giving over the governance and the exclusive legislation powers to a governor and a legislative body. That right there would have required an amendment to the Constitution. And I'm telling you, the states would never have gone for it. But because Congress just assumed the powers, the states just bit their tongue because they were getting money. The government was doing these neat things and giving them money. Anyway, then we'll cover the Enabling Act of Utah to kind of show you just exactly how tyrannical the federal government had gotten by the end of the century. There's a lot of things that we still want to cover, but one of the things itself is we got to work in, at this point in time, it'll probably be Constitution time. After the Constitution, or before, we may start covering the Progressive Era. The Progressive Era is literally where government began running insurgencies against the states and the people. They started actually going down this path. So the first thing that we want to talk about is taking over the education system, removing civics, civility, and the Constitution, the three C's. And then we'll get into this concept of social justice and the Bolshevik Revolution in America. And then we'll get into the social engineering concepts that now that we have this level of control, this is when Dewey and a lot of the progressives said, we now need to start, you know, basically pushing people towards this loyalty. We kind of covered this on Labor Day. This is kind of a part of that Labor Day where under FDR, they wanted to have this campaign of creating, you know, a fanfare for the common man. They wanted to collectivize people to say, you know, we need to surrender our our individual sovereignty as, and like Obama kind of created, this group or collective salvation. That's exactly what I believe that was what his term in many of his speeches, the salvation of many, the collective salvation. Anyway, then we're going to get into this social engineering and the normalizing of sexual perversion, the quantifying of patriotism for the Constitution as radical and perverting patriotism must be for social democracy and a new unconstitutional government. In other words, this new Bolshevik revolution, or the counterculture revolution, that basically came out of right after sex ed and the opening the doors of the perverting of America of the 1940s and 50s, goes right into the counterculture revolution, and then we've gotten to a point where they started doing all these other things, the new progressive era, environmentalism. You know, climate change, all this crap to create more and more fear so that the government can assume more and more power. The promotion of sexual dystopia or dysphoria, promoting white guilt, this concept of promoting reparations. I mean, we're constantly being dragged into these unconstitutional arguments. There is no constitutionality for reparations. There is no thing of, this is all a part of the engineering, the social engineering. The final assault is ultimately the digital currency and everything else that they're trying to do to get us to be set up to go into the new global government. Now, folks, I've been seeing plenty of AI ads, AI videos, and I don't have the time to watch them. But we've already talked about this. The day they started unleashing AI is the day they were getting us ready for the final, you know, scares, the final pushes. I'm telling you that they ran the AI models or the pandemics and those types of things and knew what they would get in the outcome. And they're actually, when you start watching and looking, they're already telling us that by 2030, in 5 years, educated people and good-paying jobs will be gone because corporations are going to implement AI for their engineering. Software engineering, AI will do it. Are you kidding me? You're going to let, folks, you're letting this crap happen. And if you're not petitioning and you're not driving and taking back our country, then whose fault is it? We already know evil exists, and we already know evil is trying to destroy us. Who has to fight back? Well, the Constitution was clear. The power is in the people's hands because the militia is to do everything. It's a part of our security. It's a part of enforcing the laws. And who is the militia, folks? It's you. So you can complain all you want to the progressive media. You can complain all you want to the corporatism and all these things, and you can continue to try to convince people to check out and get out of the system. Every idiot that has gone down that path, it's one thing to say, I really did this because I was being destroyed. I get it. But you are just as susceptible as anybody else, and if you're not fighting against this system, and you're not using that money that you're not getting taxed on to help us, then you have more blood on your hands than the average Americans that are in this fight, or even not in the fight. They're kind of in the fight. They're voting Republican, or at least they're doing a little bit because they can vote. You can't even vote. So when we really want to start assigning blame, we have to stop blaming Obama. We have to stop blaming the Clintons. These people committed treason. They need to be dealt with very specifically per the law. We have to demand the rule of law. If you want our republic back, it is a republic that is based on the rule of law. The only way you get the rule of law is you have to demand it. The framers kept on telling us, and we emphasize this all the time. I always point my finger at you. And I've got fingers pointed at myself. Kind of. I mean, I was guilty for a while, but as I started waking up, as I started realizing by reading these source documents how wrong we've all been. Now, what do you have to say for yourself? Okay, the day may come when you'll actually, because this is kind of like where we become our worst judges. We condemn ourselves, because the day your children, your grandchildren come and go, man, you saw this stuff happen. You were alive then. If they even allow you to live at that point, if you still are lucky enough to be alive, when your grandchildren will come along and say, how'd this happen? I didn't do anything. It's my fault. Because that's what you'll have to say. And though that is a tough, those are tough words to say. Nobody wants to hear those words come out of their mouth. So you better start doing something about it, America. As we go through the rest of what we need to cover the county plan, the First Amendment petitions, working and taking back the party. The only way we get rid of the party system is we have to take back half of the party. The party system is the unification of the Democrat and Republican Party, working together to basically be the opposite sides of a coin. We have to strip that off the coin and get back to the Constitution. It's interesting how everybody wants to call the Constitution political or partisan. It is the law. It is not party. And anybody that wants to say you're partisan, you're the problem. You're talking about the Constitution. We got our government. No, you don't have your government. You've stolen our government. And what you're operating is an illegitimate government driving us into ruin. And if we wake up, we can actually get rid of them and their ruinous government, their facade that they've created. So we need to cover common law grand juries, First Amendment petitions, and even these constitutional assemblies, committees, counties, whatever you want to call them. The parties and the rhinos, we want to dive into that. We want to dive into the Labor Day thing as well, Christmas, Thanksgiving. We've already kind of covered the social engineering and all of that, maybe the Department of Hugh. I mean, at this point in time, we're probably going to run out of time in 2026. But folks, this is the agenda for 2026. This is the curriculum. Do you really want me to just make, you know, stating the obvious of, oh, look at what Trump's doing. Look at how bad these people are looking by calling them out. Being a sycophant for Trump, or being a sycophant for the system or the status quo, because that's what your conservative entertainers are giving you. They're not challenging the veracity of what really is happening and what should be happening. And until somebody starts talking on a regular basis in every forum what should really be happening, then we've got a long, tough row to hoe. This is why it is my objective to try to make statesmen out of you and enough people to actually start leading in the states and the counties as necessary to take back this union. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.